Here's Dow Bennett's account of those desperate times on the Arctic convoys during the Second World War. New Year's Eve, 1944. At this time, I was serving on the destroyer HMS Keppel. She was, in her early days, one of the most powerful destroyers in the world, but that was back in 1925, when she was first commissioned. Laid down in 1919, she was not finally completed until 1925 due to cuts in defence spending. She was a Shakespeare-class leader, and only three ships of that class were built: Keppel, Wallis and Broke. They were much larger than the V and W class, which bore the brunt of the war in 1914-18. There is a picture of HMS Keppel steaming and with flags flying, and in a typically, I imagine, Arctic grey sky behind her. Originally, she carried five 4.7-inch guns and six 21-inch torpedoes, plus anti-submarine equipment. Now, after several wartime modifications, only two 4.7 guns remained, B gun and X gun. In place of A gun, a Hedgehog had been installed. This was a new weapon in the attack on U-boats. It fired 24 bombs off ahead of the ship whilst the U-boat was still in ASDIC contact. ASDIC is now renamed Sonar. The midship gun had been replaced with more modern anti-aircraft guns. Y gun on the stern was taken off, and another anti-aircraft gun installed, plus a much greater depth charge capacity. She now carried 170 depth charges in rapid reloading racks, plus several salvos of Hedgehog bombs. In the boiler rooms, number one boiler had been removed to make space for more oil fuel tanks, thereby giving the ship a greater range before having to refuel. Her previous speed of over 36 knots was reduced to 31.5 knots, about 36 miles an hour. Keppel's twin turbines produced 43,000 shaft horsepower. Her crew was 184 officers and men. Now, on New Year's Eve, she was preparing to sail, her repairs and boiler clean completed. Late afternoon, just before dusk, the bosun's pipe shrilled and the quartermaster announced, "Close all X and Y doors, close all portholes and deadlights." Deadlights are steel plates that clamp over the portholes. "Special sea duty men, close up." We were off to sea, much to the disgust of our Scottish messmate. Keppel sailed slowly down the James Watt dock at Greenock, followed by several more escort vessels out into the River Clyde and headed for the boom at Dunoon. The boom was an anti-U-boat net across the harbour. The boom ship opened up the gate and we were away. Buzzes, rumours, regarding our destination flew around the mess decks. Unknown to us at the time, the convoy which we were to escort was already at sea and we were off to join it. Destination, Russia. As Keppel headed down the River Clyde, my thoughts went back to the last New Year's Eve, 1943. Only a year had passed, but it seemed a whole lot longer than that. Then Keppel lay at anchor off the port of Sheerness. She was waiting for her sailing orders, having just completed her trials after a spell in dry dock at the East India Docks, Blackwall, London. It was while Keppel was escorting an Atlantic convoy that she rammed and sank U-229 south of Greenland. While the bows were being repaired, the opportunity was taken to install the latest anti-U-boat equipment. On the morning of the 31st December 1943, the sea was calm, a wintry sun was shining and it was cold. Soon after dinner, the sailing orders came. Up came the anchor and we were away. Our course was to the north, across the Thames estuary and up the east coast. Speed 23 knots, bows dipping and rising gently to the swell which had developed. This part of our journey was through E-Boat Alley. E-boats were fast German motor torpedo boats, and E-Boat Alley was a graveyard of ships along the east coast, victims of mines, bombs, and E-boats. As dusk fell, the ship was blacked out. Not a speck of light was to be seen. I came out of the engine room at 4 p.m, 8 bells in the afternoon watch. Fog was beginning to form, but speed was not reduced. Keppel could see in the dark. being the proud possessor of the most modern RDF set radio direction finder. It's called Radar now. By 6 o'clock, the fog had thickened, but we still kept up our speed as we headed north between the coast and the huge minefield that stretched from Scarpa Flow to Dover. Down on the stoker's mess deck, supper was being prepared. Plates were laid out on two tables. Suddenly, the ship's siren shrieked out a warning, followed by another. "Wonder what that's for?" We soon found out. Crash! The bow dipped down sharply, plates shot off the table, there was a sound of tearing metal. "Mine!" someone shouted. "Can't be," I thought, not loud enough. The mess deck cleared like magic as we went up the ladder, through the hatch and through the doors to the upper deck. Keppel had stopped and was rocking in the swell. Nearby lay another destroyer. It was HMS Vivacious, with whom Keppel had collided. A huge hole in her side near the engine room. The lights in the engine room could be seen shining through the fog. Keppel's brand new bows had been knocked off again. The bulkheads were okay, so in company with Vivacious, we headed slowly for the River Humber and Immingham. January 1, 1944. Dawn at Immingham, and the damage to the ships could be assessed. Both would have to be dry docked. 2 days later, Keppel sailed slowly across the Humber to Hessel Road fish docks at Hull for repairs. The cause of the collision? It was said later that Keppel was aware that we would be passing this coastal convoy which was being guarded by Vivacious and other ships, but the signal had not reached Vivacious that we were heading north. Having located us on her radar, she was checking on a possible enemy vessel when the collision occurred. Only swift action by Keppel's engine room crew had prevented a very serious accident, Keppel's speed having been rapidly reduced before impact. Repairs would take about a month or more. 14 days leave for the starboard watch smashing. I'm in starboard watch. Hull was just about the most convenient port for me to be berthed in. I took a train to Doncaster and then the bus home to Edwinstowe. I was sitting in the Jug and Glass having a few pints when in walked my old schoolmate and lifelong pal, Peter Pop Mason. Pop was a torpedo man serving on the destroyer HMS Musketeer. On Boxing Day, only a few days prior to our meeting, Musketeer had helped to sink the German battlecruiser Scharnhorst off the North Cape as it attempted to attack a convoy bound for Russia. Our reunion, needless to say, was quite an occasion, helped by several free pints from the pub landlord, Len Mitchell. The 14 days passed seemingly like lightning, and then back it was to Hull, where the repairs were going ahead rapidly. The port watch was sent on leave on our arrival back aboard. Hull, being on the east coast, was a favourite target for the German Luftwaffe. Whole streets around the docks were just battered into piles of rubble with the constant air raids. It was just the same in East India docks in London, which we'd only just left. While we were in dock there, the air raid siren sounded. There was little we could do as the ship was propped up in dry dock. Stoker Langland, split pin, had just staggered back on board after a beery session at the local pubs and had fallen asleep on the seat lockers on the stoker's mess deck. A sudden and tremendous crash not far away, as a fairly large bomb exploded, resulted in Splitpin, roused from his slumber by the noise and the shaking mess deck, inquired, "What's going on?" "They've dropped a big un down the road," someone told him. "Oh," replied Splitpin, who promptly went back to sleep. "I only wish I'd felt the same way." Splitpin had acquired his odd-sounding nickname due to the fact that he was so thin it was considered that he looked like one. He came from Glasgow and was a very good shipmate. It was during our stay in Hull that news reached us that the pub we used to visit near the Blackwall Tunnel had been demolished by a bomb. Walking in the centre of Hull during the blackout, leading stoker Hotcliffe collided with a metal post in the darkness. He lay on the pavement, rubbing his leg, while I, along with a couple more of his mates, stood waiting for him to get on his feet again. Out of the darkness came two young ladies, and seeing the injured, Hockley asked if they could help. "I'll be okay in a minute," he replied. He was soon on his feet and hobbled to a nearby pub. In we went, and the girls came too. Surprise, surprise, they worked there as barmaids. For Hockey and myself, it became our favourite watering hole there for a few remaining days that we were in dock. A sailor's dream, free beer. It was one of the pubs where barmaids brought beer to the table on a tray. A 2-shilling piece on the tray, and back would come 2 pints and 2 shillings change. Magic. We wished we could stay there forever. Of course, we did keep them supplied with cans of corned beef and other items, but all good things come to an end. Lined up for inspection one evening before going ashore, the duty petty officer announced, "The ship is under sailing orders. All leave will finish at 23:59 hours tonight." It was with sadness that we wished our friends ashore good luck and goodbye and returned on board. It was barely light the next morning when Keppel left the Hessel Road docks and headed out into the River Humber, a gale churning its muddy waters. Up went the revs, and we headed for Spurn Point. Rounding Spurn, our course was changed to the north, straight into a howling northerly gale. In minutes, our relatively tranquil world of the past few weeks vanished. Green seas crashed over the forecastle and roared aft. The deck was awash, and so were the mess decks. Water sloshed down from side to side on the mess decks as the ship pitched and rolled along. A steady stream of crew members visited the heads, the toilets, to be seasick, and some made it, and some didn't. Our destination was Greenock on the River Clyde. Arriving at John O'Groats, we changed course to the west and the Pentland Firth. The Pentland has a notorious reputation among sailors for heavy seas, and it was certainly living up to it now. I was on watch in the engine room, and during the watch I was required to go up and adjust the blackout screens over the engine room hatches. No light must be allowed to shine out. Over to port, the hills of the Scottish mainland stood out. Over to starboard rose the hills of the Orkney Islands and the main home fleet base of Scarpa Flow. There cannot be any other place in Britain, British Isles, so remote, perhaps with the exception of Loch Ewe, but more of that later. Young men were sent there in their thousands. Bill Cole of Luton and I had joined the Navy on the same day and had been together ever since. Before joining Keppel, we had been based at Scarpa on board the battleship HMS Iron Duke. It had been damaged early in the war and was used as a barracks with its guns guarding the entrance to Scarpa Flow. It had been made clear to Bill, myself, and about 20 more stokers then that we were not ship's company. Not that we wanted to be in a miserable dump like this. We were spare to any ships around Scarpa that required us. We couldn't wait to get away from the place. Here we were, passing it again, and hoping never to visit ever. Cape Roth. I wonder who christened it that. Whoever it was, he certainly picked an appropriate name. At Cape Roth, Keppel turned south and continued her storm-battered voyage to Greenock. And here we have another picture of poor old battered Keppel arriving at Greenock with some of the crew on the forecastle ready to moor her up to the quay. And again, she's flagging, I'm no doubt, appropriate flags to indicate she's coming in. The Hedgehog launcher had been damaged by heavy seas, but it was soon mended by the dockyard men on arrival at Greenock. Then we were on the move again, down the Clyde and off to sea. All wartime sailings were secret. Only the captain and the officers knew our destination. Buzzers swept the mess deck, commanding our next task. Canada was by far the favourite. Gibraltar? Well, maybe. Russia? Oh, no, not Russia. Nobody wanted to go there. At the mouth of the River Clyde stands the island of Ailsa Craig, known to sailors as Paddy's Milestone. Said to be an extinct volcano, it rises sheer from the sea for hundreds of feet, inhabited solely by seabirds. Keppel arrived off Ailsa and turned north. Hours later, she was entering Loch Ewe, a remote anchorage north of the Isle of Skye. Loch Ewe was the assembling place for convoys. Its very remoteness ensured secrecy, unless, of course, the Luftwaffe chose to visit the place to see if the convoy had sailed. However, at this stage of the war, a visit from an enemy aircraft would be a very hazardous one. Loch Ewe was well guarded. Keppel went straight to the oil tanker anchored in the lock and filled up with oil fuel. The motorboat was dropped and it took Captain Commander J. Tyson over to the cruiser HMS Black Prince. Ships lay at anchor all over the lock, minesweepers, frigates, corvettes, destroyers. But what interested the crew of the Keppel, the off-duty members who had assembled on deck, were the merchant ships. What we saw, with considerable misgiving, was the deck cargo of many of the vessels. Railway engines. Well, said Hockey, as several of us surveyed the scene, one thing's for sure, this lot's not certainly not going to Canada. This lot's going to Russia. The question was, would we be going with them or to somewhere else? Just at this point, mention the HMS Black Prince, the cruiser just mentioned, is seen in the photograph here, steaming into a very rough sea against a very foggy background. 20th of February. The ships were on the move, out through the boom, corvettes and frigates shepherding them into their pre-arranged convoy positions. By afternoon, the usual pipe was sounding through the ship. Close all X and Y doors, close all portholes and deadlights, special sea duty men close up. We were away with a wave from the crew of the boom ship as we passed by. The quartermaster announced that the captain would speak to the crew on the tannoy. He ended any speculation about our destination. This is the captain speaking. The convoy we are to escort is bound for the Kola Inlet, Murmansk. Russian convoy JW-57. The enemy has reinforced his U-boat fleet in the Arctic Ocean, and intelligence reports suggest that heavy attacks will take place against JW-57. HMS Keppel will escort the convoy all the way. Good luck to you all. So, Russia it was. No one was happy. The last two convoys that Keppel had escorted on the Russian run had had a fearful battering. That was back in 1942, when she was with PQ-17 and PQ-18. PQ-17 lost 24 ships, and PQ-1A suffered severe air attacks. JW-57 headed north with a very formidable escort for the 43 merchant ships. It was the biggest convoy so far to sail for Russia. The cruiser Black Prince was flagship, with Vice Admiral J.G. Glennie in command. HMS Chaser will provide air cover with 17 destroyers, 4 corvettes and 4 minesweepers. In addition, 2 more destroyers and 2 frigates would stay with us until the 26th. 2 cruisers, HMS Berwick and HMS Jamaica, would be in the vicinity until the 27th, when the convoy expected to pass Bear Island. Heavy fleet units, battleships, cruisers and fleet aircraft carriers did not go beyond Bear Island except in exceptional circumstances due to the concentrated enemy air and U-boat forces in the Barents Sea. Only the cruiser flagship and escort carriers, nicknamed Woolworth carriers, went through to Russia. On the 23rd of February, well into the Arctic now, and German aircraft found JW-57. They were dealt with by fighters from HMS Chaser. Ahead and lying in wait were 2 patrol lines of U-boats, 14 in all, according to German naval records. 24th of February, the first of the U-boats made contact with the convoy. As the ships pitched into the swell, the spray began to freeze. Soon a coating of ice began to festoon the guardrails and guns. Keppel and the other escorts were increasingly involved as the U-boats homed in and the rumble of depth charges became more frequent. By afternoon, Keppel was getting strong echoes on yet another contact. A pattern of depth charges shot off the stem and exploded in our wake. Contact with the U-boat was lost. U-713 was the victim. Its resting place is to the northwest of Narvik at 6927 north, 0453 East. This was confirmed by German naval records in Hamburg and Kiel after the war. All day long, the increasing rumble of depth charges echoed across the Arctic Ocean. When your own ship is not involved, others would be in their area. It was bitterly cold now, and the ice was getting ever thicker on the ships. B gun was permanently manned, and the crew had to train the gun round every few minutes to prevent it freezing up. There were no gun turrets on Keppel and most of the other escort vessels to give shelter to the gun's crew. They could only huddle at the back of the gun shield as the spray swirled all round them, turning to ice, even on their duffel coats. Snowstorms added to their misery. The 4.7s opened up on a U-boat that had surfaced at long range. No hits were observed before it dived. Snowstorms came and went. The ice came and stayed. Guardrails, half an inch thick, were now coated with a foot of ice. The forecastle was just one vast sheet of it. The ship's motorboat, both whalers, ship's lifeboats, and all Carly floats were frozen solidly to the ship, despite a liberal coating of antifreeze grease and the non-stop efforts of the seamen trying to batter it off with hammers and axes. Special attention was paid to the guns and depth charge throwers. And here's a photograph at this point, which shows this, well, completely Arctic scene. It's not quite visible, but in the mist and snow that surrounds these hooded figures trying to clear the ice off the deck. They could be in the Arctic rather than on board Keppel. At night of the 24th and 25th, pitch black, heavy sea and snowing, closed up to action stations yet again. They were here again, the U-boats. The sound of exploding depth charges rumbled through the darkness. Word came down from the bridge that the destroyer Maratta had been hit by two torpedoes and was sinking. Another destroyer, HMS Impulsive, was going to give assistance. As Impulsive arrived through the still falling snow, Maratta rolled over and sank, the crew jumping into the icy, oil-covered sea. Despite the desperate efforts of the crew of the Impulsive, only 17 sailors were to survive. 204 of their shipmates had joined the ever-lengthening list of casualties on the Russian convoy route. Survival in such conditions was measured in minutes, a fact of which we were only too well aware. HMS Maratta was a lovely ship, little over a year old, and one of the regulars on the Russian run. And there's a photograph here of HMS Maratta. Yes, a lovely ship. In a way, almost streamlined. And the camouflage helps that effect. The 25th of February, U-601 was sunk by aircraft operating from Shetland and at the limit of their endurance. 8 hours of every day was spent on watch. For the stokers, this was either the boiler rooms or the engine room. At least 8 or 9 times a day, the alarm bells would ring with a noise to awaken the dead. Sometimes it would last a few minutes only. Other times, it could be 2 hours or more. Then, as the depth charges shot off from the stern, more would have to be hacked off from their icy racks and dragged along the rolling deck to reload the throwers. Stokers had to help in these tasks. Ropes would be fastened to the depth charges, and 4 of us would haul it along the spray-swept deck. Between watchkeeping and action stations, we retired to our mess decks in the hope of getting a little sleep. Mess decks always overcrowded in wartime. The stoker's mess deck was below the seaman's, almost on the waterline. Under the stoker's mess deck was the forward oil fuel tank and the 4.7 magazine. There was only one entrance to the mess deck, a steel ladder leading from the seaman's mess above. During action stations, the ladder was clamped back to the bulkhead and the shells were hoisted up from the magazine to the guns above. Keppel had 29 stokers and leading stokers aboard. There was a room in the mess to sling 16 hammocks, 18 inches apart. Of course, all not 29 were in the mess deck at the same time. At least 7 would be on watch, but it was still crowded, and some had to sleep on the seat lockers. 2 mess tables and 1 small electric fire completed our home. When the weather was back, water, inches deep, sloshed from side to side as we pitched and rolled along. We bailed the water out several times a day, but it soon came back again. When the oil fuel tank below was full, all was well. As the fuel was used up by the boilers, the remaining oil would be slopping back and forth in the tank, adding to the noise of the sea alongside the side of the ship. When the tank was empty, it was akin to living over a big drum. When the ship was beset by stormy weather, and in the Arctic Ocean, that was usually the case in the winter months. The fact that the magazine occupied half the space below the mess didn't worry us. anything hitting the ship there, and our journey into the next world would be pretty swift. As already mentioned before, when the ship left harbour, dead lights were clamped over the portholes. These could not be removed until the ship was again in harbour. After several days of going on and off different watches, and the numerous dashes to action stations, the body would become disorientated due to lack of sleep and constant arousals from cat naps. Alarm bells would ring out, off the lockers and out of the hammocks at the double, fully clothed at all times. Being undressed would bring 14 days punishment if caught. Splash, as feet landed in the mess deck pond. Up the ladder we scrambled, still half asleep, as we went to our various action stations. Unshaven, red-eyed, dock-tired, cursing the Germans for ruining our sleep. Sleep? What sleep? Some of the mess deck comedians suggested that we were turning into zombies, and by the look of us, they were probably right. The forward boiler room stokers stayed in the forward mess deck at action stations, fairly comfortable. They were forward damage control and supply party. After boiler room and engine room stokers were not so lucky. Their place was aft, helping to hack the frozen depth charges from the racks, ready to reload. However, back to the mess deck. Above the seat lockers was a track along the ship's side. Small attaché cases, etc., could be fitted into it. Above the rack were the steel plates of the ship's side, now coated in a sheet of glittering ice over an inch thick. The frozen condensation and the stoker's breath. There it would remain until the ship reached warmer latitudes, when it would melt and join the pond on the mess deck. This was then our home, or igloo. We had to prepare all our own meals during our time off watch. Prepare all the vegetables, potatoes, carrots, swedes, etc. Make pies and puddings all ready for the cook. His job was to cook the food, not prepare it. Each mess prepared their own. Unlike big ships, battle cruisers, carriers and cruisers, all of which had meals prepared and cooked by galley staff, small ships were allocated 1 shilling and 10 pence a day per man to cater for themselves. Each month it was totted up for each mess. If you had overspent your allowance, the Admiralty stopped the money from your pay. Prior to sailing, the mess would be stocked with bread and potatoes. After about 3 days at sea, the remaining loaves would go mouldy, so we would cut off the sides and eat the middle. After 4 days, there was no more bread. If the weather permitted, the cook would bake some. It worked out at 1 slice per man per day, perhaps. Mostly, we didn't get any at all, but there was a plentiful supply of ship's biscuits. You could have as many as you wanted. It was just like chewing a block of wood. Potatoes were stored in sacks underneath the mess deck tables to stop them being frozen and useless, although they did get well washed by the mess deck pond. Stoker Tout was peeling the potatoes when a very large grass sod came out of the sack. Here we were, hundreds of miles out to sea, and finding that some lousy farmer had put it in to make up the weight. He should have been put on the next destroyer going to Russia. Stoker Tout planted the glass sod in the corner of the mess deck with the comment, "Nice to see a bit of land, ain't it?" Stoker Tout's family had been bombed out of their home in Croydon and gone to live in Manchester. Talk about out of the frying pan. Sometimes, due to prolonged action stations, we would have to fall back on the old standby. Corned beef, known to all sailors as corn dog. I've eaten tons of it, and I still like it. It was about this time that dehydrated potatoes became more available. A large tin containing the potatoes arrived on the mess deck and was duly opened. Inside was a scoop and an instruction leaflet. So many scoops for so many men, etc. The suggested amount was duly placed in the cooking pan. Leading stoker Block looked at it. "And do they think that it's going to feed 29 stokers?" he said. "Put some more in." Twice as much went in, topped up with water, and was then taken to the galley for the cook to deal with. Shortly after, a rather nasty-tempered cook was shouting down the hatch to the stokers' mess, inquiring if all the ship's idiots lived down there. The potatoes had swelled up, burst over the top of the pan like a mini volcano, and smoked the galley out when they landed on top of the red-hot stove. After that, we followed the instructions. Dehydrated cabbage appeared once, but it was horrible, and we didn't get it any more. Tinned spinach arrived. Johnny Block informed us that Popeye liked it and was told, "Give him ours then." I like fresh spinach, but that tin stuff was awful. The U-boats continued with their attempts to get through to the convoy. During the 26th and 27th, the rumble of exploding depth charges from Keppel and other escorts seemed never-ending. Watchkeeping. For stokers, this meant two places, boiler rooms or engine room. Before the ship sailed, the chief stoker would pin up the watch bill on the mess deck. It told you your place of duty for the forthcoming voyage. For this trip, I was engine room in watchkeeping. Thank God for that, I thought. The unlucky ones got the boiler rooms. Engine rooms are usually very hot places, but with temperatures up in the Arctic down to minus 40 degrees centigrade on occasions, it was quite comfortable. The engine room was staffed by one engine room artificer, ERA, one leading stoker, LDGSTO, and two stokers first class, STO1C, backed up at action stations by the engineering officer, Lieutenant Greenland, and an extra leading stoker. The ERA was in overall charge, his main duty to operate the turbines controlling the ship's speed. In emergencies, he was helped by the leading stoker until the engineering officer arrived. The LDGSTO kept a watch on the evaporator. This turned seawater into fresh water, mainly for boiler use. If the fresh water supply was getting low, the pump supplying the washroom would be locked off. The boiler supply came first. The STO1C, at the forward end of the engine room, tended the pumps and various valves there. Then after-end stoker watched the steering engine, the turbo generator for ship's power, the vacuum pumps, these ensured steam velocity to the turbines, and numerous bearing temperatures. Also, at action stations, when the depth charge firing buttons were pressed up on the bridge, a blue light flashed in the engine room to give warning of the impending explosions. When they did go off, you most certainly knew about it down below. Without doubt, engine rooms were number one choice for stokers up in the Arctic. Boiler rooms, on the other hand, were vastly different places. On wartime destroyers, it was not possible to travel fore and aft except along the upper deck. There were no doors or passages through the bulkheads down below. Gun crews, depth charge crews, engine room and boiler room staff all had to travel along the upper deck when going forward or aft to their various duties or to action stations. This posed no problem when the weather was calm, or even when the ship was pitching up or rolling reasonably. But when the gales of the Atlantic or Arctic Oceans struck, the upper deck of a destroyer was a very dangerous place indeed. Lifelines, steel ropes, were rigged from forward to the aftergun support at the stern. Hand grips slid along the lifeline. The usual procedure for going on watch in rough weather was to wait in the shelter of the galley flat, watching the sea sweeping along the upper deck, and judging if there might be a slight lull in the roll of the ship. Then dash out, grab a handhold and run like mad, before the next wave roared along the deck. Sometimes we made it, sometimes we didn't. Going on a four-hour watch with legs saturated in ice water was no joke. Other times we'd swing our legs up and hang from the lifeline as the water swept past underneath. Occasionally, during very severe storms, the sea sweeping across the deck would be so heavy that anyone out there would get swept off the side with no hope of rescue whatsoever. Then the crew on watch would have to stay there until it was thought safe to travel the upper deck again. Going along the deck in bad conditions was hair-raising enough, but imagine having to do it at night with the ship blacked out. It was a nightmare. So much for movement in bad weather. Back to the boiler room. Boiler rooms were entered via a hatch in the upper deck. The procedure was to go along the deck to the hatch and open up, giving access to the airlock. Airlocks were necessary to maintain a higher boiler room pressure than the outside atmosphere. On entering the airlock, You would clamp up the hatch above your head as you descended the ladder, something like clambering into a telephone box from the top. At the bottom of the ladder, you would open up the bottom door and close it behind you, or no one else would be able to get in from above. You couldn't have both doors open or pressure would be lost. The bottom door gave access to the gratings level with the top of the boilers, then down the ladder to the bottom. In the forward boiler room of Keppel there were two boilers, each one having 13 sprayers, flamethrowers, through which the oil was pumped in. They were surrounded by a mass of machinery, water pumps, oil fuel pumps, pressure gauges, etc. Overhead at the side were four big fans to pull in the air and create pressure great enough to prevent the sprayers backflashing into the boiler room and engulfing in flames anyone unfortunate enough to be there. At slow speed, the noise was fairly reasonable. As speed increased, on went more and more sprayers. Up went the speed of the sprayers to keep the pressure up, and up too went the noise. High speed, steaming, the pumps were going like the clappers, forcing oil and water into the boilers. At high speed, Keppel was gobbling up 10 tons of oil fuel per hour, and the fans were flat out, making a din so loud that only sign language was possible. You couldn't hear anyone shout. It was not for the faint-hearted. A destroyer boiler room with the glare and din from the sprayers. The Stoker Petty Officer, SPO, was in charge. His task was to check the oil and water supply to the boilers and to adjust the fan speeds accordingly. Low air pressure or low oil temperature would create black smoke. High air pressure or high oil temperature caused white smoke. Any kind of smoke brought an immediate reprimand from the bridge. He was helped by a leading stoker in charge of one of the boilers. Two stokers, first or second class, operated the sprayer controls with eyes glued to the pressure gauges. They either opened or closed the sprayer valves when required, without orders from anyone. They knew what to do and did it. Up to now, in the Arctic Ocean, with the ship pitching and rolling, spray and water would be sucked into the fan shafts, where it would hit the ever-howling fans and be flung into the boiler room like a mist. Water dripping from the fans turned to ice in the rush of air, so large icicles, sometimes as thick as a man's body, formed just a few feet away from a roaring boiler. In such conditions, quite contrary to everyone's expectations of a stoker nice and dry and warm, he was going to on watch, clad in oilskin to keep him dry from the constant deluge from the fans. If he was lucky, he might even get a duffel coat to help him keep warm from the icy blast. Stokers were later kitted out with kapok suits for all boiler room watchkeepers. So, in this cavern of ice, flame and din, old Stokes kept his watch, hoping that he would never have to come to such a godforsaken place as the Arctic in winter again. At action stations, no blue lights flashed in the boiler room to warn of imminent explosions as they did in the engine room. I don't know why. Depth charges and occasionally bombs would explode out of the blue with a hell of a din. If the depth charges were on shallow settings, the first one would cause the lights to flicker. By the second or third, the lights would go out, and lit only by the glare of the sprayers and with torches and emergency lights on, the pressure and water gauges, the stokers carried on as usual until the fuses were back in, usually fairly quickly. No wonder we preferred the watch in the engine room. On one occasion, the relieving watch had just reached the boiler room. They were rather wet, having been caught by the seas up on deck. I went into the airlock, clamped up the bottom door, climbed the ladder and waited until the ship rolled back, hoping that the water had drained back over the side. The ship rolled back, now, I thought, and opened the top hatch and began to climb out. Suddenly, an unexpected wave crashed along the deck. There was no chance to get out or get back down, and before I could close the hatch, the sea poured in, icy cold, and half filled the airlock. At the next attempt, I managed to get out and fasten the top hatch. I reached the galley flat, wet through. An airlock, half full of icy water, waited for the next stoker to open the bottom door. What a greeting. 28th of February, the convoy arrived at the Kola Inlet, entrance to the Kola River, and further upstream, the port of Murmansk. Although it was claimed to be ice-free, the Kola River had its share of ice floes drifting out to sea. The U-boat stayed with us till the end. Most of the escort vessels used up most of their depth charges. Keppel had three left. 167 had been fired, plus several salvos of hedgehog bombs. Hundreds had ensured that JW57 arrived safely, despite the attention of 14 U-boats. While the merchant ships went on upriver to unload at Murmansk, the escort stayed at the Russian naval base Poliano, with a few going across to the village of Vahenga. Keppel was at Poliano. As soon as possible, the ship's motorboat was cleared of its coating of ice. Off it went to the cruiser Black Prince and came back with a load of freshly baked bread for the crew of Keppel, who had not had any for several days. Other escort vessels were also supplied from the cruiser and the escort carrier, both of which had baked hundreds of extra loaves for us. Deadlights were opened, portholes too, and fresh air quickly replaced the stale air of the mess decks, although the portholes were soon closed as the air was bitterly cold. The mess deck was cleaned up, stoker touts, grass sod being dumped into the Hubba Harbour. Meals got back to normal, and we enjoyed a lovely, lovely sleep, although we were rudely awakened by the arrival of the Luftwaffe. They were dealt with by the anti-aircraft guns of the Red Army, sighted all round the place, and fighters of the Russian Air Force. We made a visit to the oil tanker to refuel and to the ammunition ship to reload the depth charges ready for the return journey. Then back along the jetty with permission to go ashore. With plenty of fresh water available, we could have a bath as well. Bath! The washroom for the crew was very small and had no baths, no showers, and no running water at the 6 or 7 steel wash bowls. As already mentioned, fresh water at sea was only available after the boiler and cooking arrangements had been satisfied. If the ship was low on fresh water, the pump in the adjoining flat was locked off. Also, when the ship sailed, it was under orders no one to be undressed at any time, so no bath at sea for anyone. Back in harbour and bath time, get a bucket, fill it with warm water from the galley, go to the washroom, strip off, tip some of the water into the washbowl and soap yourself down, then tip the remainder over yourself. Bath completed. With clean clothes on and whiskers shaved off, it felt wonderful. The mess decks were clean and dry again, food back to normal, sleep more or less okay, bathed and changed, we were ready to step ashore.